Hi, everyone. I'm Ashley McManus, Senior Director of Global Marketing at SmartEye. Welcome to the Human-Centric AI Podcast, where each episode we feature thought leaders doing cutting-edge work in the AI space. A little bit about us. SmartEye is the global leader in human insight AI, technology that understands, supports, and predicts human behavior in complex environments, bridging the gap between humans and machines for a safe and sustainable future. We have a very special episode today featuring iMotion's product specialist, Dr. Pranila Bulow, and Dr. Eric Barasa, an associate professor in the Department of Biological Sciences and Physician Assistant Studies at Mississippi College. iMotion's is a fully integrated hardware-agnostic software platform that allows researchers to use the power of any neuroscience technology, as well as traditional surveys and focus groups, to gain unparalleled insight into what people actually think and feel. At iMotion's, Pranila consults and trains academic and commercial researchers on multimodal biometric data collection and study design. We are joined today by iMotion's customer, Dr. Barasa, who joined MC's faculty in 2014 and currently teaches vertebrate histology, pharmacology, virology, cell physiology, pharmacology of infectious diseases, and pharmacology and therapeutics. One area of his research expertise includes alterations of normal attention and memory in patients with anxiety disorders. Currently, his research efforts are focused on identifying the abnormal neurocircuitry that induces and maintains anxiety in patients with anxiety disorders. Eric, Penny, and I talked about mental health and education and performance research, the role of biosensors in mental health research, and Dr. Barasa's work in studying test anxiety in students using biosensors. Let's listen in to learn more. Okay. Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us today. With me, I have Dr. Pranila Bulow and Dr. Eric Barasa. Thank you both so much for making the time to speak with me.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So let's start briefly. Tell us both about your background. Maybe Pranila, we'll start with you.
Sure. So I have a PhD in neuroscience and a bachelor degree in psychology and neurobiology. And my whole journey into neuroscience really came from being interested in those big questions about what makes people who they are, what is it that really drives them, things like that. And so now I get to consult and advise researchers on exactly those big questions at iMotion's, where I'm now a product specialist, which means I'm both a research consultant and also work as a tech expert.
So I started kind of similarly. I did my college degree in psychology, and then I took a little bit of a left turn and I did my PhD in pharmacology and toxicology. And then I was a professor for a while and I got bored, and then I decided that medical school sounded like a good thing to do. And then I got bored of that. And so now I'm back to academia, and my research has taken a lot of twists and turns, but I've sort of found my way back to the brain. And it really did start actually quite psychological. And then I started adding in like my biosensors. And so it really kind of then geared towards more neuroscience stuff. But I am not a officially trained neuroscientist. I sort of learned on the job. And so now I've been here for about 9 years working at Mississippi College and doing research and teaching.
Awesome. All these smart people. I don't know what we're going to talk about today. Let's ask both of you, why did you start working with biosensors? What do you think is the coolest aspect of biosensor research?
Do you want to go ahead and start, Eric?
Sure. So for me, what interested me was my ability to kind of pull back the layers of what I was seeing from the behavior perspective. You know, so I was always looking at how do people respond when I put them in X, Y, or Z condition. And that was interesting enough, but now to be able to actually see what is the brain doing when their behavior changes, that was really the interesting piece to me. I had no plans of doing this initially. It was actually my department that said, would you please be more, you know, biological in your research? And so I said, fine, buy me an EEG and I'll make it biological. And that's how I kind of fell into this. And so that's what I find interesting, is being able to peel back those layers of the brain's activity.
Yeah, I really resonate with that. I actually started in biosensor research when I worked with mice. And so I was measuring heart rate, which is a very different way of measuring heart rate than you would do in humans. But it was a the exact same types of benefits that you get with using biosensors in humans, which is that you get the data in real life, in the naturally behaving animal or human, without really necessarily having to stick something into them or make something very uncomfortable and different about their daily life. And so biosensors, I think, and I know we'll be talking much more about this, but they have a huge potential to really uncover what's happening in your day-to-day life, what's really making you tick the way you are. So what is happening during those different types of thoughts you're having, those different types of experiences?
Cool. Awesome. So in terms of today's conversation, there's two different parts I wanted to do. So to start, I wanted to talk about, you know, introducing performance and the education field. So maybe we could start with you, Penny. Why is it important to address mental health and education and performance research? And Eric, feel free to jump in if you have thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't think anybody is unaware of the mental health epidemic that we are living through in the US, at least. Mental illnesses have skyrocketed, not just because of the pandemic, but also prior to that. Okay. If you look specifically at schools and looking at student populations, almost half of all high school students struggle with long periods of feeling sad and lonely. And around 1 in 3 college students and college athletes have actually experienced or currently struggle with depression and anxiety. What's really sad and frustrating as a mental health expert and as someone who is very, very passionate about that topic is that only 40% of those people typically receive therapy or other forms of mental health support. And so, you know, and I can keep listing it, you know, 66% of college students struggle with loneliness. That's a risk factor in itself for developing mental illness. In contrast, if you're looking at, you know, adults in general, it's 1 in 5. Now, it's also a huge problem in the adult section. But when you're looking at students and you're looking at performers in maybe the student population, like college sports, you're seeing huge amount of mental health problems. So this is something, you know, I think that cannot be overstated, how important it is that we address mental health in the education and performance areas.
Yeah, I mean, I look at my students as an example. So I work with university level students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I specifically study test anxiety. And yeah, I mean, we talk about, you know, hey, if you're depressed, you know, go seek counseling, go to health services. If you have anxiety, do this. If you have some sort of other, you know, Axis 1, Axis 2 disorder, the problem that we're running into is, like, at least with my research, is test anxiety. And you can imagine, like, oh, that's probably through the roof. Yeah, but it's not even clinically recognized. So at least with depression, someone can say that is mm-hmm. depression and we have a standard treatment. Yes. But there's this big population of students who there's something wrong, but we don't even have a word for it, let alone a diagnosis, let alone a treatment. And so mm-hmm. I think kind of the next generation of research is going to focus on all of these unmet needs mm-hmm. of these students coming through. And yeah, it definitely does not start at university. It's starting way earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. we're definitely going to talk about that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about performance, oftentimes we forget that, you know, the education system is one big performance hall, right? So we know that, especially now, a lot of students struggle with mental health. How is this being studied with biosensors?
So obviously Eric is going to be talking a lot about that. Yeah. So I'm gonna give an overview of someone who works in that field and works with a lot of different types of researchers who work with education and students. First off, absolutely agree with you that the education system often turns into a performance assessment. Having moved from Denmark to the US, that is something that very starkly came to mind when I started doing my bachelor research and bachelor studies here in the US. You know, going from never having a test, or at least only having tests at the end of the semester, I suddenly had 3 midterms, you know, and an exam. It was like a never-ending process. And so obviously one of the really big challenges that are very unique to the US and the student population is that there is this large number of tests that students constantly are evaluated on. And of course, there's a huge amount of pressure on performing very well. And what I think is a little bit, again, frustrating, but also sad, is that we should focus more on mental health among students reason being that students perform better when they're happy and when they're engaged, when they're well rested, all of those good things. So there's a huge motivation that is not really talked about, but actually is what really drives the student performance and ultimately school performance, which is such a big thing here in the US too, when we talk about school rankings. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about, as you the second part of your question was how are they actually evaluated? What type of biosensors are they using? Eric is going to talk about his research, which is happening in a laboratory. And so that is a very common setup, especially if they want to test things like depression, anxiety, stress during different specific tasks and general assessments. This could be, for example, with EEG, eye tracking. It could be galvanic skin response. It could be a lot of really, you know, different metrics, which really could benefit the education researchers, because that field typically is very survey heavy, which means usually students are being asked, what is your opinion on this? How are you feeling right now? Right. But they're not necessarily, first, they might not be able to name it, as Eric mentioned. And second, they may not want to mention it. And third, they may just not have the awareness of, oh, actually, I am depressed right now. Or even, I don't care if it's subclinical, I'm subclinically depressed right now. That's also bad. Yeah, yeah. You don't have to fulfill all the criteria in order to, to need to have an improved environment to live in. And so these lab-based setups are really, really powerful. What we're also seeing from our company perspective and being a consultant is the need for wearable biosensors. So when we're putting biosensors on people, which could, for example, be like a Fitbit or an Apple Watch or things like that, and then we can monitor people's behavior out in the real world. So we can test students and see, you know, what's going on when they are going from class to class, what's happening during their lecture on XYZ, what's happening during their training in different fitness arenas. Can we see that their mental health gets worse the more they train, or is it getting better? And so those are the types of questions that, you know, researchers can address with biosensors in the education field and performance field.
I know for me, I am one of those lab people right now. I do all my work in the lab. And, a lot of what I do study, it would almost be impossible to look at in a natural environment. But there are still, even for my very specific types of questions that I have, there are some things that could absolutely translate to more real world applications. And I think it's important to always keep that in the back of any researcher's head when you're studying something and you get really down into the weeds and you have this one very specific brain trace or something like that. There's a larger context that you're probably missing because it's out of a natural environment. And that's going to be true for animals as much as it is for us.
Yeah, no, it's really that trade-off between like ecological validity. So like how relevant is this really to the natural world and what's actually happening? And then understanding what are the factors that are actually contributing to your research. And so that's the downside of doing any of these types of wearable biosensor research out in the real world, because there's so much that could influence your results. You don't have as much control over that.
Yeah. So how long do you think it will be before we start implementing biosensors in, for example, you know, monitoring high performance people's mental health? You know, could you envision a time where all performers have their mental health evaluated in a way that can inform their training practices? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think that's already happening. As I mentioned earlier, nowadays, everyone has a wearable watch with various sensors in it. Not everyone, I don't have it, but a lot of people do. And so even if this is not a research organization-driven project, most people are monitoring themselves. They're monitoring their performance. They're monitoring their diet. They're monitoring their sleep. Now, we can ask the question of whether or not that's actually healthy for people. But what, from a research perspective, what we actually really do need to ask is, how accurate is that data? Can we actually use that biosensor data and inform and improve performance and mental health based on it? And that really speaks to what Eric mentioned before, which is that the lab-based research does give you more valid data, more data that's really reliable. And so, again, we're talking about that trade-off. Because really, one thing is to track performance, and then the other thing is to change behavior and training practices. So, for example, for a performer, you could imagine seeing that they're getting like a mental health screening or an anxiety screening or something like that over the course of their daily lives. And then the trainer can use that to inform whether or not they're sound for practicing, sound for going on the field to play. And we are slowly seeing that those types of changes are happening, which has been shown in the news more recently too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think with the advent of some of these like third and fourth generation smartwatches, mm-hmm. like Garmin watches for runners, as an example, is one that I'm more familiar with. It'll track your VO2 max. It'll track your heart rate variability as well as your heart rate. You now have like the Oura Ring, which will track your sleep schedules and tell you what stage of sleep were you likely in and what percentage recharged is your battery. And if, you know, my mother did one of this, she got like the Oura Ring and was like, oh, it's so cool, you should try it. I'm like, Ma, I don't trust anything that's actually telling you. But then I saw a head-to-head of a actual like in-laboratory VO2 max test against, I think it was the Garmin watch. Mm-hmm. And it was less than 2% deviation from the watch to the actual real VO2 mm-hmm. max test. And I was like,
oh, wow.
Like if we are really getting that accurate kind of data, who doesn't have a smartwatch or an Oura Ring or fill in the blank piece of technology? And yeah, that's a gold mine of data that you could pull from.
Yes.
In a realistic environment.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's really powerful. And a part of, you know, what we're doing at iMotions too, is that we want to make these wearable biosensors available, but really focusing on the ones that have the highest quality of data, because it would be so cool and so fantastic if you could have students or performers where you're screening them prior to and after, you know, that is not just the data itself can be informative, not just for diagnosing, but then also for predicting and monitoring anything that's happening. If you had a panic attack or something like that.
I mean, really, how is it really much different than, say, 15 years ago, having someone before they join a big basketball club, or I don't know what you call it. I clearly don't do sports. You know, having them all have an EKG done to make sure that they don't have like a Brugada syndrome or something like that that's going to cause sudden cardiac death. How is that different than today? Just saying, well, let me look at your cadence rhythm using your Fitbit or whatever to make sure that you don't have a mild hip injury that's going to cause a problem, you know, next week.
Yes.
How is it any different? It's just, it's new technology, but it's the same sorts of questions. We're trying to predict performance.
Yes. Yeah. But clearly we have not gotten good enough at it yet. So hopefully these technologies can be better at it and also capture them during the actual session, right? So you can imagine as they're on the field, something's happening that the biosensor is picking up on that is something the trainer can then pick up on, say, hey, take a break.
Yeah.
So fascinating. Okay. So now when it comes to, you know, student performance research, Eric, you really are an expert, which brings us to the second part of this, which is student test anxiety with biosensors. And I know you were alluding to this earlier, but Eric, can you tell us what motivated you to study test anxiety specifically in students?
Do you want the real answer or like the rehearsed one that I tell people to make myself sound really smart?
Whatever is in your heart to tell me, that's what I want to know.
Well, I like you guys, so I'll tell you the truth. So I was in med school, and I think it was my second year. We had to do a research project. And I thought to myself, okay, well, I used to do some research back in college on cognition. And I have a whole bunch of really high-strung med students here. Let me look at test anxiety. And so I did a little project with that, and it was kind of interesting, but it's like one of those stupid, like you're a second year medical student, you're just making stuff up at this point. But then when I came here at MC, they were like, hey, so start doing some research. And I kind of fell back into the test anxiety stuff. I just started doing actually like better research because I had better facilities and I was a little bit wiser at that point. And then they just started throwing technology at me, said, hey, buy an FNIRS, buy an EEG, buy all this different types of equipment. And I just sort of stumbled across a lot of interesting findings. And so I said, you know what? This is now my life. This is my career. This is what I'm going to do.
Oh, nice. There you go. Perfect. Very cool. And what is it that you are asking in your studies? Are there particular groups of students that you're more interested in research-wise?
Yeah. So my research questions are at this point pretty broad. Okay. Well, both broad and narrow. I guess I'll explain. here's the thing that I have found. When you go and you like hop on PubMed or something and you say, hey, what research has been done on test anxiety specifically from a neuroscience perspective?
Okay.
Crickets. I think in the history of the world, there's been like 4 studies that have been done. Okay. And the ones that were done that were published were not that great. And so anything that I find is interesting. Mm-hmm. So that makes my life kind of easy.
Yeah.
But I've gotten really into specifically attention and attentional processes. Mm-hmm. And so when I do my very specific questions, that's kind of where I go. And my original overarching theme was, well, test anxiety, it's got anxiety in the name. It's probably anxiety. And I wanted to show that it was with the argument of, well, if it is, then we should include it with a test anxiety diagnosis because currently it's not. What I've actually found out is that it is not like other forms of anxiety. It is quite distinct and kind of hard to pin down at the moment. And so when I look at people, when I focus on my students who have test anxiety and I want to study them, I completely ignore what they tell me they have. Because you'll have people who will say, oh, I'm really test anxious. But then I run them through a battery of tests. No, you're not. That is a normal response to being unprepared for a test. That is normal.
Okay.
And you'll have people who will say, I absolutely do not get anxious about tests. I don't have a problem. And through the roof scores.
Wow.
Yes, you are. You are absolutely test anxious. I'm now to the point that I don't care what you tell me is the problem. I will let your brain do the talking for you. I will listen to your brain and it will tell me what's really going on. And maybe is that an issue with metacognition? They're just truly not aware, or are they embarrassed? Or maybe they had a bad test performance, then they want to use that as an excuse and say, oh, I'm just really test anxious. I don't really care what the reason is. I don't listen to it anymore. I just want to listen to your brain.
What types of biosensors do you use to ask these questions, and how are you studying this?
98% probably of what I use is either EEG, FNIRS, or eye tracking.
Okay.
And I'm probably the most proficient with EEG. So I do EEGs all day long. Once in a while, I have a project that I use an FNIRS for. Sometimes I use eye tracking. But yeah, that's mostly what I stick to. I know Penny's been trying to push me towards other biosensors, and I'm starting to incorporate a little bit of other stuff, but that's more just me dabbling at this point.
Mm-hmm. What is it, Eric, if you don't mind, what is it that first struck you at the level of the brain when you're looking at these students that were coming in? You're seeing some were saying they were anxious, some were saying they were not anxious, but then they looked, there's something about them that looked distinct enough so that you can categorize them in a different way. What stood out to you there?
I guess my initial finding that I was kind of like, huh, that's sort of interesting, was I had them do a task where in some part of it, they just had to do this task. But in another part of it, there was an indicator off to the side of their performance. And the idea was, well, if you're test anxious, you're going to be really hyper-focusing on the performance indicator. So you're like watching that. But if you're watching that, you can't be watching the task. And so your performance will actually tank. But the trick is the performance indicator off in the corner is not the real performance. It's just made up numbers, made up very low numbers. And so I'm essentially telling them that you're really bad at this task. And what I was able to find was that not only does their real performance tank when they're focusing on that negative indicator, but their brain, kind of in the back of the brain, starts showing me an indication that they are ignoring the task and they're hyper-focusing on the side, which is where the performance indicator is. And so it's not just them you know, I don't know, like thinking about the task differently, or they keep looking over, their brain literally has shut off looking at the task and is just focusing on the performance indicator. And that was my first confirmation that the brain is doing something distinct.
Mm-hmm. Have you tried to do any studies where there is no performance indicator to see, you know, those people that say they come in with test anxiety, what do they look like when there is no performance indicator?
Yep. So a couple things that I've noticed that are different, even if there is no indication of a problem, is one, if you like, well, if we, you know, non-test anxious people, by the way, I'm actually quite test anxious, according to my own studies. If you take a person without test anxiety and you do have them do some task and they make an error, we all make errors sometimes. Your brain sees it and your brain has a very sharp response to making that error. People with test anxiety don't have that. Their brain completely ignores the fact that they made an error. Or at least it would appear to me that they're ignoring it. Maybe they're actually hyper-focusing on it, but the brain doesn't show that typical signature. So that is one thing that I can notice, even if there is no performance indicator. The other thing that we see is there's a balance between what we call beta waves and theta waves on EEG. We call it the theta-beta ratio. The higher that number usually means that their attention, ability to switch attention is not as good. And we often associate that with like attention deficit. People with test anxiety have it too. Mm-hmm. But they don't have attention deficit disorder. I've ruled that out. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Although, interesting. Because what I'm thinking immediately is that, does that correlate in any way with being distracted by the performance meter? So when you're getting the performance feedback, is that also because you are having some level of, you know, ADD and you're constantly distracted by this element that's moving over there?
Well, so it's interesting with ADD, you'd expect it to be any flashy object would attract their attention. And that's not the case. It's only if it relates to a performance. That's what captures their attention. So if I showed them a gunshot wound over in the corner, or if I showed them a knife, their brain is able to ignore it like a normal person. Okay. But if the word failure happens anywhere on that screen, I have now captured their attention. So it is specific for like just performance indicators or the testing specific concepts.
Can I ask one more question?
Of course. I love answering questions.
Okay. So have you tried? So what I would expect based on what you're describing here is that the students with test anxiety would also have longer dwell times and like eye tracking focus on negative words that are associated with performance, or might even prime them much more efficiently to reduce their performance in different tasks.
Yes.
Is that something? Yeah. Okay.
That is absolutely true. It has a term. It's called attentional bias towards threat. And my test anxious students absolutely have an attentional bias towards threat, if and only if the threat is test specific. So words like failure, examination, grades, but not to words like murderer or gunshot wound or bankruptcy. So it is specific, but they absolutely have an attentional bias towards threat.
Okay. So the students that come in and say, I don't have an attentional, I don't have any test anxiety, but then they show all of the correlates for it in the EEG, in the eye tracking. How do you explain that? Is that compensating and being really good at being a resilient student, or what's going on?
Well, that's my guess. And so, yeah, I believe that it is a compensation. And so my thought of what is happening is, you know, with people who say, oh, I get really test anxious, like to the point that they pass out or something, you know, that they get that anxious. I have really bad test anxiety too. I am great at taking tests. And so you say, well, what's the difference then? I think the difference is they probably have some test anxiety and some, you know, neurological problems there. And then when they take the test, if they do poorly on the test, whether it's because of the anxiety or for some other reason, we have now just set up a learned response.
Yeah.
And you do this over and over and over again. And every single time you take a test, you have this bad outcome. You learn to really start to have this true anxiety response to taking a test. Whereas for me, I've not had those sorts of bad experiences. I've always done very well on tests, even though my brain has the same signatures as that other person and is processing information the same way. I didn't have those bad outcomes. Or at least not nearly as often. And so I was more likely to be resilient. I've probably found unconscious ways of overcoming some of my deficits. Because actually what I found is that in the case of, say, learning, you would think that people with test anxiety would have a problem learning. One of my most recent experiments, in fact, they outperform on a learning task than non-anxious people.
I would kind of expect that those people, at least as long as they don't get to a point where they're hopeless and feeling of despair, that they are extra motivated to learn, right? Because they feel this extra pressure to perform well at their test.
Granted, the test that we ran them through is not like a medical physiology exam. It was a task where they have to, you know, estimate 1.7 seconds has elapsed, hit the space bar when you think it's happened. So it's a very different type of a learning task and much less pressure. But yeah, they were better at learning it and they did not forget it as quick.
Totally makes sense with general neuroscience research that's showing that, you know, we have an inverted U curve with a lot of things. And this is true too with cortisol. And so you're peaking at the right level of cortisol and you're going to be much better at learning, acquiring knowledge and remembering it. And you get that dopamine boost if you then get the feedback that you did it right. So everything's consolidated better, but, and yet they still have test anxiety.
And actually, so that whole feedback thing, that is the topic of my talk next week at the Society for Neuroscience. Their brain does not respond to feedback. I have yet to get their brain to respond to feedback, which is weird because they should be hyper fixating on the feedback, but their brain is not seeing it. And I don't know why. So yeah, test anxiety has turned out to be a really cool thing to study because every time I think I know what's going on and I make a hypothesis, I am proven wrong again, which just means I get something really interesting to talk about.
Yeah, that was really cool.
I was interested to hear, you know, do you imagine that this data will impact the way, you know, student test anxiety is perceived in, you know, the broader education system?
I hope so. Both from the perspective of teaching students, like, hey, this is what your brain is doing differently.
Yeah.
So let's lean into it. Like, because there are strengths there. And so you'll know what your strengths are. You know what your weaknesses are. Let's lean into your strengths and find a way to compensate for your weaknesses. But the only way that you can do that is if you know what those strengths and weaknesses are. And then from like more like my perspective, so like a faculty member or like student disability services, knowing that this is a thing and just saying, hey, we'll give them double time. Giving them double time or extra time on a test for test anxiety is probably the exact opposite of what you want to do. It probably would make it worse. But are there things that we could do to accommodate for that potentially? Hopefully this becomes more broadly read by a more lay audience, and we can use that information more broadly to improve students' lives as well as improve the education system. Because kind of going back to what Penny had said, Denmark is a very different place.
I was just thinking, like, you know, you have been alluding to it as well, but what's causing test anxiety? Who gets it? That I understand there might be a genetic component, but is it an experience dependent process as well? If so, is that something we can modify in the early years instead of starting to test them out early in the classrooms? Should we only assess them moderately, at least?
I have no idea how to answer that. I would say from the testing perspective of like just testing students. Yeah. I mean, if you say, well, America, we're really good at testing people. Then how come we're really not good at educational outcomes? You know, you look at countries like Denmark and Finland and Sweden. I mean, they've got much better educational outcomes and they don't have the testing rigor that we do, but yet their students perform better. And so I would say definitely we could maybe take a cue from some of our across the pond friends and change up our testing procedures a little bit. In terms of like whether this is genetic or not, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, simply looking at the proportions of people that have this signature of test anxiety that you have identified across different cultures and countries would be.
Yeah,
super interesting.
That's really cool.
Well, maybe if you can get me some contacts over in Denmark.
I'll go right on it.
take this study global. We also had spoken about wearables earlier, and I'm wondering if a future step to do your testing inside the classroom versus inside the lab, or not so much?
Yes and no. So I think in terms of like EEGs, are there portable, wearable, comfortable EEG sets that are out there? Sure. Do I rely? Could I rely on them? It's questionable.
Yeah.
And then it's because it's so poorly controlled, how would I extract out the little piece of what their brain is doing? That's of interest to me. So I don't know that I can go that route yet. However, with thinking about more just traditional stress responses, one of the best things that you could look at would be heart rate and heart rate variability. Mm-hmm. And using things like a heart rate monitor, I mean, those are easy to do. And what would be nice is if not just say, hey, take this test and let me watch your heart rate, but let me watch your heart rate and heart rate variability for a few days going into the test. And when you really ramp up your studying and when you're about to take the test and when you're taking the test and then when you're done taking the test, that might give me some information about how your brain is responding to both the acute stress of taking the test as well as the anticipatory stress preparing for it.
Yeah. It would be interesting to know if how that correlates with the EEG phenotype that you have identified during the in-lab setup, where you could imagine that the ones that respond to feedback and the ones that don't may also have a heart rate signature that, you know, you can correlate between the two.
And God, wouldn't that be so easy if all I had to do was take your pulse and be like, yep, test anxiety.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's how a lot of people think it is, right? They think, because they have a high heart rate when they are taking a test, they are thinking they're anxious. There's a lot of other states that you're in when you have a high heart rate.
Yeah, I wonder if it's not just necessarily the heart rate itself, but maybe the heart rate variability give me an indicator of how balanced your autonomic nervous system is at that particular moment.
Absolutely. Yes. The level of flexibility that your body has. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, on that note, I will open it up to either of you to share your biggest takeaway for listeners from this conversation, or if you have any advice for those looking to implement these kinds of tools and techniques in their research.
I guess I could take the comedic route and say, be like me and just take whatever... And just take whatever your research was already and just say, hey, what would happen if I stuck a EEG on top of it or a heart rate monitor on top of it?
One way to go.
And it's worked out well for me. So I guess I could give that piece of advice. I guess maybe my biggest piece of advice would be this. Don't be afraid to jump into something that's completely unknown to you. My research when I was doing my PhD was on brainstem angiotensin receptor expression in heart failure rats. I mean, so this is what I was doing. Definitely was not doing EEGs or FNIRs or heart rate variability. I was working with dead animals is what I was doing. And then, of course, with medical school, your goal is to not kill somebody. And so jumping now into what I'm doing, I was definitely not trained to do this. But every single time I go to a conference and show my work and talk to people, they're always like, wow, you're such a brilliant guy and you're doing this great stuff. It's like, yeah, but I kind of just fell into this. And so I guess that would be my perspective. I started working with, not to plug you guys, but I'll plug you guys. I started working with iMotions pretty much from day one of my EEG stuff when I literally said, how do I stick this contraption on someone's head? And now here I am, 5-6 years later. There's always going to be a group out there who can definitely help you get through those initial humps, but you never know what kind of interesting stuff you're going to find. So don't be afraid to try something new would be my recommendation.
I'm just going to ride that wave. I work with so many people, researchers, they have a PhD in communication or they have a PhD in psychology and they haven't worked with biosensors before. And so they find it intimidating sometimes. But getting over that hurdle, understanding the technology, I mean, first off, you can always find collaborators that can help you in that journey. And obviously, you can also come to companies like ours where we can actually assist you in that process. But the information that you gain is marvelous and very remarkable. So I would just...
Plus one.
Whatever Eric said, I say too.
I really love that narrative of kind of keeping an open mind. I do think that's relevant regardless of industry, career path, like being open to opportunities really as they come your way, even if you're not necessarily like that's your area of focus. So I love that. And that's all I have for you. So I do want to remind our listeners to register for that webinar. We'll link that in the show notes, where we're going to dive even deeper into these topics. But in the meantime, Pranila and Eric, it has been a pleasure. And thank you so much once again for taking the time to have this really fascinating conversation with me today.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
It was really fascinating to hear what the brain can tell you about test anxiety and how some students' self-perception of whether or not they had this anxiety did not necessarily reflect their reality. This latest in the iMotions Mental Health content series continues to be super timely, and I can't wait to see more in-depth research about it at the webinar event. We have lots more content coming out, so stay tuned for more. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the Human-Centric AI podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts for new episodes. We're also on social media, so please reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram to share any feedback you have on the show and weigh in on the discussion using hashtag Human-Centric AI podcast. Don't forget to rate us and comment with your feedback to help make the podcast more discoverable for others. Until next time, thanks for listening.